This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And perhaps a theme of the outgoing Obama administration might be something like mission not accomplished or mission nebulous. Here is the president speaking to U.S. troops at Fort Bragg in 2011 about ending the war in Iraq and lessons learned.
It's harder to end a war than begin one. Indeed, everything that American troops have done in Iraq, all the fighting and all the dying, the bleeding, and the building, and the training, and the partnering, all of it has led to this moment of success.
We know, of course, what happened to that moment of success, the dreamed of peace in Iraq. But what of other conflicts? Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna this week to meet with foreign ministers, and he wants to end a UN arms embargo to Libya imposed in 2011. Here's Secretary Kerry speaking on Monday in Vienna.
The arms embargo does allow for the government of national accord to request weapons if it needs them specifically to secure the country and to combat Daesh.
Kerry wants U.S. weapons in the war against Daesh or ISIS. Does this arrangement mean U.S. boots on the ground?
We're not talking about troops and boots and that kind of intervention. We're simply in a mode of trying to help and assist and develop a Libyan capacity to be able to respond to the challenge of security within Libya.
Maybe the reason Secretary Kerry said that is that he knows the U.S. already has boots on the ground in Libya. The Washington Post reported last week that two special operations units totaling about 25 people have been stationed in eastern and western Libya since late 2015. There are quite a few boots on the ground in Africa, it turns out. A conference this month in Tanzania confirmed that there are U.S. troops in Uganda, maritime forces in Senegal, troops at a huge base in Djibouti, forces in Ethiopia and Somalia, Burundi, Mauritania, and that's part of a much larger push under President Obama to increase special ops units in Africa to the point where the U.S. military is now involved in over 90% of Africa's 54 countries. A lot of what we know about U.S. forces in Africa comes from the work of Nick Turse, who's author of Tomorrow's Battlefield, U.S. Proxy Wars and Secret Ops in Africa. Nick Turse, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Also here is William Wexler, who oversaw special operations from the Pentagon during the Obama administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism from 2012 to 2015. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. William Wexler, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
William, can I just ask you if generally the scale of what we think are the operations in Africa sounds correct to you? Is it fundamentally different from what went on in the Cold War? Am I characterizing this, close to bullseye here?
I think in general, your characterization is correct, but it might be misinterpreted by people listening. The vast majority of the work that's being done is simple training and liaison work, and that kind of work goes on in country after country around the world and has gone on for decades and decades. What's different about what's going on right now is the common threat that many of these countries are feeling from Salafi jihadists, whether it's al-Qaeda or whether it's Ansar al-Sharia or whether it's the Islamic State.
But isn't it the case that if those threats become more real, then those troops are right there to be activated and with prepositioned equipment and materiel and communications gear operating from Djibouti, boom, we're in a conflict.
It's certainly possible. It's certainly something that you have to worry about, but it's unlikely. The fundamental question that that policymakers need to ask themselves is whether sending a small detachment of special operations forces to do the equipping and training and advising and assisting work to help other countries fight their own fight against terrorists is something that prevents the United States from being in a real conflict, or something that is the slippery slope to getting the United States in such a conflict. People who see the world through the Vietnam lens have ample reason to worry about the slippery slope thesis. But our more recent experience shows otherwise, as we've seen in Colombia, as we've seen in the Philippines, as we've seen on the African continent itself in the last number of years. There have been good experiences that we've had where properly managed, properly overseen very small deployments of special operations forces actually keep the United States out of such a conflict by enabling the local countries to fight their own wars.
All right, William Wexler, I'm going to come back to you on that precise issue there, but let's get a sense from Nick Turse. What do you think of the scale of U.S. involvement in Africa as you've managed to report this, and we're relying on your numbers here?
Sure. I mean, we've seen exponential growth when it comes to the U.S. military's operations in Africa. When U.S. Africa Command, the umbrella organization for U.S. military activity on the continent, when it began operations back in 2008, it inherited 172 missions, activities, programs, exercises across the continent. By 2013, the combined total of all U.S. activities on the continent reached 546. So we're talking about an average of more than one mission per day. In 2014, that number leapt to 674. So U.S. troops were carrying out almost two operations, exercises, or activities, from drone strikes to counterinsurgency instruction, intelligence gathering to marksmanship training, somewhere in the continent every single day. So this represents an almost 300% jump in annual activities. And I think this is something that the American people just don't know about. The same thing, at the same time, we've seen U.S. military outposts on the continent grow in exponential ways. When I took a look at the end of last year, I counted up a remarkably extensive network of more than 60 outposts and access points scattered all over the continent.
What do you make, Nick, of William Wexler's suggestion that these are all initiatives to actually prevent the U.S. from getting involved in wider warfare, and that, in fact, they are insignificant individually?
Well, I think, taken as a whole, you can't say that this is insignificant. I also think that, Mr. Wexler talked about the Vietnam model. I think this is a very, it's very dangerous to have, this many troops prepositioned all over the continent. We've seen again and again that the United States generally does not, begin small and then end missions in a orderly manner. Since 9/11, if you look at our military engagement around the world, we'll begin with a smallish force. When Secretary Rumsfeld talked about a small force necessary in Iraq, we did go in with something small, not small like what's going on in Africa, but a smaller force, and it was necessary to increase that force over time, again and again, surging in more troops, and we've seen where that's led us. Small force for the invasion of Afghanistan, that also began as a special operations and CIA operation, very small, and it's grown and grown and become a quagmire that the United States doesn't seem to be able to get out of.
William Wexler, you can respond to what Nick Turse is saying there, but let me just ask you, you said a moment ago that these missions in Africa are designed to prevent the U.S. from getting involved in wider conflicts. Shouldn't there be some other goal of these missions other than to simply prevent the U.S. from being involved? What good comes of these individual missions that we can say is of strategic importance to the U.S. relationship with Africa?
Sure. The strategic importance is the existence of the Salafi jihadists on the continent of Africa. What we've seen time and time again is that when these kinds of terrorists, not all kinds of terrorists, we're not in a war on terror, not all kind of Islamic terrorists, not even all kinds of Sunni Islamic terrorists, but these kinds of terrorists, the Salafi jihadist terrorists, whenever they have a sanctuary from which they can act with impunity, they inevitably and inexorably eventually go to external attacks. And we saw that in Afghanistan, we saw that in Yemen, and we saw that in Syria. And now we're starting to see these same groups with these same ideology and the same pressures upon them gaining that kind of sanctuary in places like Libya. And we can wait until they do those external attacks, or we can learn from history and try to approach it in a very different way than the way that was just described that Don Rumsfeld approached it. In fact, this is the opposite of how the Bush administration approached it. This is not an occupation. This is not direct action by and large. This is indirect action. This is working by, with, and through others on the ground, people who are indigenous to the area, people who have legitimate governance over the area, and who want to extend that governance over ungoverned areas in order to deny terrorists the ability to commit their terrorist acts. That's a legitimate act from legitimate governments, and they're seeking the United States' help. Not the United States to fight their fights, but the United States to help them train, equip, and give them the kind of advice on the basis of our learned skills over the last decade and a half.
But why go in at all? I mean, there's certainly plenty of evidence that the use of American military hardware in Africa has created enormous civilian deaths around the continent for whatever reason. And the U.S. can't be blamed for that, but we do become a kind of supplier with our troops on the ground being marketing agents for an arms industry that does, and many people have talked about this, guns do create in Africa a level of carnage that wouldn't be there if the guns weren't there.
Well, that's certainly true, and it's a huge concern, and it's one of the things that the United States, you know, is extremely focused on to make sure that the wrong types of weapons don't get into the continent, that the right kind of weapons don't get into the wrong hands. And while there are ample examples of mistakes that have been made over the decades, I do think that there are also examples of situations that have worked out quite well. I mean, and most of the countries that you're talking about are not countries compared to, say, Iraq, who have huge budgets for these weapons. Most of the weapons sales that are going to be taking place are through Western governments that are going to be able to be in a position to help decide what kind of weapons are most appropriate. Now, that said, the issue that you raise is a very important one, and that's why these, the proof is always in the execution for these kinds of operations. Can you execute in such a way that you minimize the downside risk and you maximize the upside potential for the very small operations that you're doing? Even in places like Somalia, for instance, where in the just a decade ago, very serious people really thought that that was going to be the next Afghanistan. And for all the problems that Somalia has, and there are huge numbers of problems, the reality is it hasn't. And Al-Shabaab, even which is the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group that does horrific things both in Somalia and with its neighbors in Kenya, is not nearly the threat that it was considered to be not that long ago. And that is no small reason due to the work that the United States and others have done indirectly helping the Somalis and the local partners fight this battle themselves so that we don't have to fight it for them.
Nick Turse, respond to anything that you heard there of William Wexler. And before we go, give us a sense of the scale of this base in Djibouti that you've talked about.
Sure. I did want to respond to Mr. Wexler about the fact that, the United States began to develop a real presence in Africa after 9/11 in an effort to head off potential terrorist threats. I'd like to point out that at the time, the Pentagon did not even recognize one transnational or transregional terror group in the region. If you look at a U.S. Army War College report from 2000, it talks about internal separatists or rebel movements or weak states, things like warlord armies, but it made no mention of Islamic extremism or major transnational threats. Fast forward to today, and no less than Brigadier General Donald Bulldog, the head of U.S. Special Operations Forces in Africa. Last year, he admitted that there were close to 50 transnational or transregional terror threats in Africa from east to west, mostly along the northern tier of the continent. This has been a startling increase, and it's mirrored the increase in U.S. engagement, base building, special ops missions, drone missions, and the like. While correlation doesn't equal causation, it really is striking and suggests that that U.S. efforts in Africa haven't helped matters. Now, John, you mentioned Camp Le Menier in Djibouti. It was once a French Foreign Legion base, And you can still find French troops there today, but now the base is overwhelmingly American. The camp has seen the number of personnel stationed there jump by about 450% since 2002. It's expanded from 88 acres to nearly 600 acres and has seen more than $600 million already allocated or awarded for projects there. And there's another $1.2 billion in construction that's planned for the future. This has been a major air hub on the continent. There are fixed-wing manned aircraft that are flown out of there. It used to be a major drone base, but drone operations got to be so extensive that they were now moved off to a another base in Djibouti called Tchibeli Airfield, which the United States military doesn't like to talk about. But they're flying drone missions in Africa and also across in the Arabian Peninsula from that drone base now.
Nick Turse is the author of Tomorrow's Battlefield, U.S. Proxy Wars and Secret Ops in Africa. His new book, Next Time They'll Come to Count the Dead, War and Survival in South Sudan. Nick, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
And William Wetchler is former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism from 2012 to 2015. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. William, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.